You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Susan Sontag, and we're going to be talking about her new book, The Volcano Lover, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. She's the author, of course, of several previous novels, The Benefactor and Death Kid, A Book of Stories, I, Etc., a story published on its own called The Way We Live Now, and six books of essays and criticism, two published film scripts, as well as two additional movies. And it's a great honor to have you here. I wanted to begin by talking about what kind of book The Volcano Lover is, because much of what I've been reading about it doesn't seem to correspond to my experience of it.
It doesn't correspond to my experience either, Mike.
I took it to be a kind of fantasia on received materials, that the romance of Emma, Lord Nelson, and Lord Hamilton is a kind of given around which many interpretations and styles are woven.
Well, that's true for the way it started, but I have to admit that I did get caught up in the story. Maybe that's why it's reaching so many readers. I did get caught up in the story on a gut level. And maybe I started off by thinking, I have to be very careful. After all, this was the subject of a famous film with Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh playing Lord Nelson and Emma Hamilton 50 years ago, and everybody's seen this movie of, you know, on video or whatever, and it's a corny story and it's history, so what can I make of this story? How can I turn it into something else? But then I did actually get caught up in the story itself. I have only my own sensibility and quirks to bring to it, but I really like telling the story, and this daring and intimidating choice of setting a novel in the past, in fact, two centuries ago, writing what's called, not a very prestigious label, a historical novel, that I was really terrified of doing, actually was very liberating for me. It liberated a narrative gift, a straightforward narrative gift, storytelling gift that I didn't know I had. I thought precisely what you say now, that I would take the story for granted and it would be a fantasia, it would be all sorts of riffs on these people who are so well known and are sort of cliches. And it is full of riffs and stories within stories and fables and so on, but it also is the story. I was completely caught up in the story. I cried when I was writing some parts where terrible things happened to my characters, and I fell in love with them. There's a lot to be said against them, but I did my best to. I wanted to justify them and to present them in their full humanity. I identified with them. I mean, this was nothing to do with any theory I had about what I was going to do. I found it was a big emotional blast to write the book. I didn't know it would be that. I started off more with the notion that the book would kind of float above the story, but the story is really there, and that's what I think makes it work for a lot of people. Because there's the other stuff too, of course, all the digressions and fantasies and fables and stories within stories.
I guess what I mean is that it has the feeling of being a novel in a glass booth, that to some extent the characters are on display in it as characters, as representative figures. They're given not their own names, but representative names, the hero, the cavaliere.
The young woman, the cavaliere's wife, right.
And there's a kind of ongoing commentary, which often, to me, now perhaps I'm quite wrong about this, but some of the themes on collecting and traveling, they seem to me to be to use the metaphor at the beginning, shopworn, as if the book is encased intentionally in a network of received ideas.
Well, I don't know. It's interesting that you say that. The notions of collecting, tourism, exile, travel, passionate relationship to art, and so on, maybe they are shopworn, but they didn't seem shopworn to me. They're the kind of things that I'm drawn to. I mean, for instance, you know, I had a whole period where I was mostly writing essays, and I think I was trying to carry this cargo of obsessions and passions through a very narrow door. I take the theme of collecting, for instance. I mean, the main character, the volcano lover, Sir William Hamilton, he's a collector. And I know one of the things that got me interested in photography, apart from the fact that I'm a very visual person, is a notion that I really started off with, that having photographs is collecting the world. And the notion of the photographic possession or appropriation of the world is a variant of the theme of collecting, and the kind of dissociation that comes with a hyper development of the collecting instinct. So I could say, well, I've always been interested in the psychology of the collector and the phenomenon of collecting, and now I had the courage to work with the fictional character, based, as it happens, on a real person, of a collector, and I could bring ideas and fantasies and observations that I have about the psychology of collecting into an organic relationship with a story, instead of segregating all this and making it a sort of one-voiced in an essay form. The thing about a novel is you can have it. You can have many voices. This is a novel that addresses the reader in many voices. There's not only the different characters, but there's the many voices of the book, of you know, all this commentary and digression and arias and so on. So I don't know. I guess I don't agree with you in the sense that I don't think love, for instance, romantic passion, which is one of the, I don't know, whatever I call it, a theme or subject or something of the book, it's certainly shopworn, but it isn't any less interesting for that. And I think
I was not using shopworn as a pejorative. Rather, I felt as I was reading the book, and I could be quite wrong, that in the same way that Flaubert builds Emma Bovary out of used things that he has a certain amount of disdain for, but nevertheless he creates a passionate novel.
Well, of course, that's a very glorious comparison, and if that's what you mean, I couldn't agree with you more. But precisely what makes Madame Bovary so great is that he may have thought, and we know this from his letters to Maxime Ducamp and Louise Collet and others, he said, I'm writing this boring novel about this provincial doctor's wife who has a couple of disastrous love affairs and kills herself because she's basically a mediocre person. And then in the writing of the novel, he really identified with her. You may start off with these sort of bracketing or condescending attitudes to your material because you want to be in control, you want to be superior to it. But I think fiction really works best when your sense of that material being used is completely transformed. I mean, I think it partly has to do with how you psych yourself up to write a very ambitious book. This is certainly the most ambitious book I've ever written. I think it's the best book I've ever written. And first of all, to write it, I had to give myself permission to fail. And maybe even to attempt it, I had to say, okay, everybody knows this, and this is something that, yeah, we know about this. We know about this famous triangle, the Hamiltons and Nelson and the French Revolution and all of that. Now, what can I do with this material? But I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that the other part of it is, yeah, used materials, even like the surrealists, found objects.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Why, you know, actually, I tell you, if we have time, I can tell you a little bit of some of my initial thinking about the book. I got interested in these people. And then I thought, well, why do I want to base it on these people? Why don't I just make it up? But it'll be for a few knowledgeable people, they say, oh, yeah, that was based on the story of the Hamiltons and Nelson and that whole world. And I even had the idea at one time, as if that would have been any easier to do, that I would make the main character and have it take place now, and I'd have the main character, an ambassador, the American ambassador to the Philippines, and he would be a collector of Chinese art, but he would also be fascinated by volcanoes, because that was the case for Hamilton as British ambassador to Naples at in the late 18th century. So I'd have this, I could do it now in the 1980s or the 1990s, American ambassador to the Philippines, volcanic eruption, great collector, and do the whole thing as a sort of modern version of that story. And then a few people would say, wait a minute, it sort of reminds me of that old story. People say, oh, you've written a historical novel. I remember one review, talk about the reviews not making sense to me. And, you know, as you know, the reviews have mostly been very favorable, but they still don't make much sense. One reviewer said, well, this is a historical novel. That's very strange. Susan Sontag couldn't like historical novels. Of course I like historical novels, because an awful lot of novels are historical. I mean, War and Peace is a historical novel. Tolstoy wasn't writing about events in his own time. He was writing events that took place in his grandparents' time, and he had to do a lot of sort of reading and working it up to know what was going on.
Well, to some extent, The Benefactor is a historical novel.
Sure. The past is a big place. And you know, the novel is such a sort of wonderful hybrid thing. People want to be moved. Well, I, as a writer, want to move people. I was very moved, cried even a couple of passages that I was writing. Readers have told me that they cried, that they were moved to tears by some of the passages in the novel. It's also funny. I also laughed a lot of times at some things I was writing. There is information in this book. It's not Moby Dick. I'm not trying to give an encyclopedia of whaling here, the equivalent about volcanoes or anything like that. But you can learn something from this book. That's a pleasure you get from novels. There's the education of the heart. There is getting information about interesting worlds that you don't know about. And actually, we don't know anything, so we can always learn. There's speculation. There's fantasy. They're riffs, what I call riffs or arias. It can be a big feast.
Well, I have to tell you what I read, and we'll see whether it was in your heart or mind, or both.
Okay.
You know, what I found very moving about the book was that it seemed to be a book about the death of everything, particularly about the death of love. It seemed to be about the process in which the things that one holds culturally dear are turned, after being lava, into hardened, petrified memories, memorials to an eruption that is now over and can be collected, but even the objects of the collection turn valueless. The heroes and heroines of the book end, you know, inevitably impoverished and dead. Life is like this, but novels not always. And so I took it as being a book about the death of culture and passion.
Well, you're right. You know, I'm probably not the best person to talk about this book, even though I wrote it. And I didn't finish it so long ago. I only finished it about 4 or 5 months ago. It was published in record time. When you say that, it's absolutely convincing to me, and I can respond to that. I have those feelings. There's one line that made me laugh grimly, but I don't feel it's me. I feel it's the book. The book says, "It was a time when knowledge was fashionable, Philistinism was unfashionable," and I wrote that line with a great deal of glee and grimness, because the time we live in is a time in which knowledge is unfashionable and Philistinism is very fashionable. And I was thinking when I was writing it, you know, how, well, to take one of the great examples, you know, think of James Joyce's Ulysses. You know, it all takes place in 24 hours. All the stuff that he unfolds in that book, but the characters don't change. Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus and Molly Bloom. They are what they are, and what makes the book is all the changes that Joyce rings on their identity, their characters, their sort of mythic prototypes from the Ulysses stories and so on. But you've just got 24 hours. I mean, all that happens in Ulysses is some people meet and hang out together for 24 hours. I mean, literally nothing happens.
They get more and more tired.
And they get more and more tired, yeah. And the book gets wilder and wilder. Here, this book has, God, it has a lynching, it has a guillotining, it has a war, it has a romance, it has childbirth, it has betrayal, it has adultery, it has, you know, life at court, it has music, it has, you know, it has all these elements. It doesn't have horse race. I think of that because of Tolstoy that I read somewhere that Tolstoy, when he started Anna Karenina, I mentioned War and Peace before, but now I'm thinking of Anna Karenina, that he made a list of things that should go in a big novel, and one of them is a horse race. And sure enough, of course, he does have Vronsky and Anna at the races at one moment. And this is an expansive book. It has a shape. The shape was kind of hard to figure out, but I didn't start writing until I had figured the shape out, because you cover 40, 50 years and a bunch of celebrated people with a lot of public as well as private activity, and you could, you know, what do you tell? What do you leave out? I had to have a form. But you're right. It follows that arc of a human life, and which is, roughly speaking, they're full of beans at the beginning and they're, you know, they're down and out in one way or another at the end. I mean, of course, Lord Nelson, you know, dies in glory, but at the Battle of Trafalgar. But, you know, he has suffered some tremendous blows. I mean, not only being mutilated, but the end of his marriage and this very anguished, passionate relationship that he has with Emma Hamilton. Although, I mean, there's no doubt that if he could have, he just would have come home and married her and settled down in the country. But that was not to be. And so they all, in fact, end very badly. I think it was a big trip, you know, to do this. I think I liked writing it. I had no idea it would reach so many readers. I had no idea it was going to be a bestseller. And I had somebody, you know, told me to look in a crystal ball, and I had seen that piece of information. And it wouldn't have helped me in the slightest, and it couldn't possibly have influenced me, because I don't know how to write any way than the way I do. But I did have the feeling, without even daring to think of how many people would like it or not like it, I did have a feeling about a third of the way through that I was on to something much bigger than I had envisaged. And by the end of the book, before anybody had read it, I did think it was very original and the best thing I'd ever done. That's the most I can ask of myself.
I'll tell you, I thought early on, almost as soon as I heard about it, that it would be a bestseller. What came partially because from The French Lieutenant's Woman on.
But see, I've never read The French
Lieutenant's Woman. I'm making a comparison.
But I just say it in the sense that there are these books which are, quote, historical novels or romances like The French Lieutenant's Woman or Possession by A.S. Byatt. And I know these books are out there. And I'm sure I'm going to sound like an awful snob, but I have never even looked at these books, much less read them.
No, but they do tend, these anti-romantic romances, Darwinian Victorian novels, to capture an audience. What impressed me about The Volcano Lover, personally, because I'm indifferent to those books too, was that I did think that it was a Sontag book.
Good.
I didn't find it to be disparate in theme from either the fiction or the essays. In fact, I liked it because it offered a continuity.
Well, thank you for saying that, because now I know you really do understand the book, and that's exactly what I expect of you being you, but it's not a satisfaction I have had very often since the book came out a few weeks ago. A lot of people, I don't know what they're reacting to, more an idea, I think, than any real knowledge of my work, have treated this book as if it's some kind of new phase and very different. I feel that everything I've ever done is in this book, and I don't know how to write differently. That's why I'm not jealous of other writers, and I'm not worried about other writers, and I enjoy the success and accomplishment of other writers, because I couldn't do what they do, and there are a lot of American writers I admire, but I couldn't do it if I wanted to, and I know that nobody would want to do or could do what I do. I mean, this book is, what makes this book different is that it's freer, it's more expressive, and that I, you know, that I did find the right form, that I could hook all these things. I'm coming back to your original idea of the used material.
Well, what I found was, I'm talking, by the way, to Susan Sontag about her new book, The Volcano Lover. What I found was that, let me try and get this correctly, that if you took what they are calling nowadays the polyphonic novel, the novel by Hermann Brosch or Kundera, that the interpretations within, especially in Kundera, are set at a bizarre angle to the ongoing telling of the story. What interested me here was, in fact, it almost fascinated me that a certain kind of despair, a certain kind of world weariness enters the book and begins almost to be amused by itself. It knows that world weariness has been around as long as its characters have. And so I found the book to be utterly original in its manipulation of emotions, events, received materials, and finally, you know, a very almost celebrating mournfulness.
Well, I think this is the smartest thing I've ever heard about the book. It certainly, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I never thought of it, but it absolutely. Nobody's ever said anything smart about my book like. I think it's true. But still, I want to insist on the euphoria that there was in finding a voice for this because, well, we know from art, you know, it can present the most gruesome things, but there's a kind of elation. I'm not saying this is all gruesome, but, you know, you can present there is gaiety in Beckett
or absolutely.
Thomas Bernhardt or the most pessimistic writers.
Well, I mean, the joy of wonderful prose is joy enough. I mean, you know, don't you think?
Yeah, but not just the prose. There's some pretty fancy prose in here, but just the sense of, I don't know, the kind of feeling you have. Oh, I'm using an Emersonian term, but I can't, a phrase I'm thinking of one, and I can't remember the sentence, but the feeling of being a world devourer, you know, that you actually can sort of take it all in and give voice to it. I mean, my model at times was a musical model or even more specifically an operatic model that you could just stand stage front and center and belt it out and say, I long, I love, I fear, I dread, I want to die, I want to live, I protest. Then that's what, of course, it gets to toward the end when I have the four monologues of the four monologues of the angry women. But they have to be earned. I mean, I have to tell this story and do all the variations on it. But it's interesting what you say. It's very interesting what you say. Our listeners should know we haven't talked about this before. This is all just coming out spontaneously in this conversation. I mean, you mentioned Hermann Brosch. I always think I like Hermann Brosch, but then when I read it, I love the idea of it, you know. And then when I read it, I think, you know, where's the pep? Where's the energy? Where's the velocity? It kind of gets, it's turgid, and it needs more energy. It needs more euphoria. When I read Kundera again, I love the idea of it, but for the most part, I'm very dissatisfied. I think he's too in love with his own ideas. And a lot of the ideas aren't that interesting. They're sort of obvious. And he's too superior to his characters. I don't feel superior to these characters. I put a lot of myself in every single one of them, which is maybe why I brought in Baron Scarpia from Tosca, so I'd have one stage villain that I couldn't identify with. I don't feel superior to these people. I don't feel condescending. My beloved son, the author David Reif, when I first told him about this book, and I probably described it very badly. I'm not good at describing my own work. But I'd told him what I was going to do or what I thought I was going to do. This is before I'd even started. He said, ever witty, I know you know him. He said, oh, I get it. Herman Brock meets Barbara Cartland. And I thought, oh, God, is that true? Of course, I've even seen a book by Barbara Cartland, but I sort of know what it is. And then I used to tease myself and in a way almost egg myself on. Maybe it's why I put a romance as a subtitle, as a kind of grin to myself. I say, okay, it is a romance. It's got a romance in it, and it floats. It floats. You talked before about the kind of generic names of the characters. It isn't just Horatio Nelson, you know, Lord Nelson, Admiral Nelson. It's the hero. It isn't, you know, and they all have their names because I wanted to have a kind of mythic character, or I wanted it. What I guess I have to say, and it's very simple, is that the book, while it was planned out in a rough schematic way, it did take off and got richer, and I gave more to the actual storytelling. I found myself moved to give more to the storytelling aspect because it was so moving than I actually had expected. Originally, I thought, again, here I'm betraying how little contemporary fiction I read. I've never read one line of John Fowles, but not only do I know he's written a book called The French Lieutenant's Woman, but I know he's written a book called The Collector, which I've never even seen or read. And when I started the book, I thought, oh, God, what a pity The Collector is used as a title, because this should be, you know, the title of my book. You know, Sir William Hamilton, Collector and Volcano Lover. Unfortunately, I can't use The Collector. It's already been used by this famous novel. So I guess I have to call it The Volcano Lover. Of course, The Volcano Lover is a much better title. And had The Collector not been used, I still would have been well advised to call it The Volcano Lover. But I really thought it was about him. And I thought, oh, that well-known shop-worn story of Emma and Lord Nelson. Well, everybody knows that from the movie or from somewhere else. I can just allude to that. There'll be shadowy figures in the background. And then Emma comes along and kidnaps the book. And her vitality, I love self-made people, people who come out of nowhere and create themselves and rise out of their own fantasy and energy and wish not to be a victim. She says, I'm not a victim. Well, the book says on her behalf, she didn't want to be a victim. She was not a victim. And, of course, she could have considered herself a victim. And Lord knows she was at the end. I love people who have this optimism of the will. And so I cared about these people. And I wanted to tell their story. And then I wanted to ride their story, to tell other stories as well.
I've been talking to Susan Sontag, the author most recently of The Volcano Lover. It's been a pleasure to have you here, Susan.
Thank you, Michael. You have been incredibly illuminating about my book. I thank you for this conversation.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Crossan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop, die.